I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are stepping away a little bit from the bodybuilding world, a little bit. We are going to interview Charlotte Parker, and Charlotte Parker is in the public relations business, and she was Arnold Schwarzenegger's personal public relations manager for 15 years during the height of his career. She started working with him in 1984 for the movie Conan the Destroyer, which was the sequel to Conan the Barbarian. And she worked with him on Terminator and then all the way up until his top movies, I think all the way up until Junior. So Charlotte was with Arnold and helped him shape his image in Hollywood and really helped make him the number one movie star in the world. So I learned of Charlotte from reading the book Fantastic, which was a biography of Arnold Schwarzenegger written by Lawrence Lehmer. Came out several years ago. Really, really well-written book if you're interested in Arnold's life. But Lawrence talked very highly of Charlotte in the book, saying that she was really responsible for Arnold's career in Hollywood, making it all the way to the top like he did, not only as an action star, but he was at one point the number one movie star in the world. So I love movies, of course. You guys know that. We listen to this podcast regularly, and I love Arnold. This is going to be a real fascinating interview for me, so I'm really looking forward to talking to Charlotte Parker in a few minutes here. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. We got some emails from our last interview with John DiCola, which was part two. Of course, last week we did not have a show on the podcast, which is unusual. I think I'm going on now 4 years of doing this podcast. I think this July will be 4 years. We started it in 2017. And I think we've only missed like maybe two or three shows, 2 or 3 weeks. But I just could not get the interviews lined up. I had a few people lined up and nobody could do it by last weekend. So we ended up not doing a show last week. So we are back and we should have a couple shows for the next couple weeks. So I'm good for at least a couple more weeks. During my break, I did an interview with a guy named Scott Strong, and I will have the link to that interview right here in our description of the podcast. And also, if you're listening to this on YouTube, it'll be also on YouTube. Scott is a young man who is just starting a podcast. I think he came from a powerlifting background. He's going to do his first bodybuilding show pretty soon. And he listens to the podcast regularly, and he was a big fan of it. And we had a really good interview. I think we did like a two-hour interview. So as I said, I'll leave the link down there in the description if you guys want to check that out. Also had some bad news. Andy Hammond, who was a professional bodybuilder, got his pro card as a master's competitor, passed away a couple weeks ago, about a week and a half ago, at the age of 55. And his wife wrote on Facebook that she believes it was from a recent elbow surgery. And then he had a blood clot that traveled, I think, to his lungs because he ended up with a pulmonary embolism and he ended up dying from that. So it was kind of a freak thing. But a lot of people pay tribute to Andy because he was a great guy, a real good family man. And if you're familiar with Andy, he used to do guest posings all over and he would try to always do something different. I mean, dressed up as the old time strongman, like around the 1800s. and he would dress up as, I think, Mr. Fantastic or something from the one of the characters in one of those animated series. I can't remember which one it was, but he was always a character, and he always dressed up and tried to make people laugh and did a lot of crazy things, and everybody had some great things to say about him because he was just a really, really good person. Good family man. I think he had four kids. His son is now older, and he was talking about him on Facebook as well. Rest in peace, Andy Hammond. We're really sorry to see a great guy like that go at only 55 years old. That was really a shame, real tragedy. So all the best to his family. Before we get to our emails, I also want to mention I got a book here from my friend Pat Comer, who always sends me all these great articles that I always read at the end of our podcast. And he actually sent me the book Pumping Iron, the revised edition. And so at the end of this book, they have a section there, a few chapters in here written by Charles Gaines about the sport of bodybuilding in the 1980s. Well, actually, 1980 itself. That's when they had the Miss Olympia contest. And that's also, of course, the year Arnold came back and won the Mr. Olympia. So Pat said I should read some of that. So I'm going to read a chapter, chapter 14. I'm not going to read the whole chapter, of course, because it's very long, but I'm going to read a portion of the chapter where it says the sport and the art in 1980. So I thought that was really interesting. Always great to read Charles Gaines' stuff because he's the best. All right. So we did get some emails. So I'll read the emails first. If you guys want to email me, of course, that address is naturalolympia@gmail.com. This one is from Lee, and he says, "Hey, John, hope you're well. Just want to say I love the interview with John DeCola. Great guy, good knowledge, and the sport. I could have heard a part three. Keep these interviews coming, as listening to these legends and training are the foundations of how to build your body their experience. Through experience? I'm not sure what he said there. In terms of guests, as always, Rick Wayne, three parts, because once you get him, you'll have to get everything. Gary Stridham, I'm friends with him on Facebook. I think that would be cool. Another name that would be interesting would be Shigeru Shigeta. Keep up the great work, Lee." All right, thank you, Lee. Yeah, Shigeru Shigeta would be great. I'm not sure if he speaks English. I'll look for him on Facebook. I don't think I really see him. But if anybody has any contact information for him, let me know. I'd love to talk to him. Former NAVA Mr. Universe winner. This one is from one of our Patreon donors. If you guys are interested in donating to the show via Patreon, you can do that on our bodybuildinglegendshow.com website, which is in the upper right-hand corner. And Andrew Heffernan is one of our loyal Patreon donors. So thank you, Andrew, for your contributions each month. I appreciate it. So Andrew wrote me an email, and he said, "Hey, John, I love your show. I'm a loyal Patreon, and it's some of the best money I spend all month. I had two quick thoughts for you. Number one, a few weeks ago, you answered a training question on the show, and I thought, how cool would it be if you made that a regular segment on the show? Tips from a natural Mr. O. To that end, I'd love to hear your thoughts on integrating cardio into a training program. I know competitors often stay away from it, except when trying to cut up for a show. But what about regular guys who want to keep up their cardio health and stay athletic while also maintaining good muscle size? How to fit it in optimally without having to train 10 hours a week? Any thoughts? Second, a suggestion for an episode, who owned the pose? You, Jerry, Tom Terwilliger, and or any other aficionados could run through the compulsories and discuss who did which one the best. Robbie's double by, Haney's front lat, Arnold's side chest, and so on. And then maybe discuss individual signature poses. Zane's vacuum, Boyer's mantis pose, Mensur's twisting back. Could be fun. I would love to hear the crossfire when discussing bodybuilding goats. All the best, Andrew Heffernan." That's a great idea, Andrew. And I emailed Andrew back and I told him, I think I'm going to do that. So I already contacted Jerry Branham. He said, of course, he's in any kind of discussion on bodybuilding. Jerry's in. So I think I'll contact maybe Tom Terwilliger, maybe Phil Williams. He's always a great guest to have. And yeah, that's a great idea. We could run through the different eras, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, 60s, see who had the best compulsory poses. I think that's an awesome discussion. Oh, question about the training. I would incorporate cardio. I would think like 3 days a week, maybe 4 days a week would be good. Of course, with bodybuilding, we always try to do cardio where you're going to hold on to your muscle mass and you're not going to lose muscle, because that's always the problem when doing too much cardio and dieting. I know as a natural bodybuilder, I always had to worry about that. I always had to walk this fine line of trying to get lean and get ripped but at the same time not lose your muscle. Because the advantage guys taking steroids have, of course, is they can do a lot of overtraining and a lot of cardio, and they won't lose that muscle because the steroids will hold on to the muscle. With natural bodybuilding, of course, we can't do that. So that was always my biggest concern when I was getting ready for a show, was how do I hold on to all this hard-earned muscle mass that I spent all year trying to build? I don't want to lose it the last 12 weeks before the contest when I'm doing all this cardio and dieting. So I think a good moderate program of cardio would be 3 days a week. You could do 20 to 30 minutes right after you get done with your weight training. That way you'll burn mostly fat for energy. And I think that would keep you lean, and it would also keep your cardiovascular system in shape. If you really wanted to work your cardiovascular system, I would maybe add 1 or 2 days of HIIT training, which is high intensity interval training. And that's when you do that with the cardio. How you would do that is you alternate, for example, running with walking. Or what I like to do is I'll do the exercise bike, sprint for like a minute, and then rest for like 2 minutes. When I say rest, I mean just pedal really, really easy, and then sprint again for a minute. You can play with that different times. You know, maybe you go 45 seconds, or maybe you do it a minute and a half, whatever. But that is really, really great for building your cardio because it's so intense. Problem with that, again, is if you're dieting, you have to really be careful about losing muscle. If you're doing the HIIT training with your cardio, you want to do that later in the day after you've had a couple of meals, because you're definitely going to be using carbohydrates for energy because it's so intense. The other type of cardio, the steady state, you could do that after you get done with your weight training, when you've burned carbs for energy with the weight training, and then you could burn fat for energy when you're doing the cardio. Or you could do it first thing in the morning on an empty stomach. And because you have no food in your system and your blood sugar level is low, you will also burn fat for energy. So you will get leaner either way. So that's how I would do it. I would stick with 3, maybe 4 days a week, depending on what your goals are. If you just are trying to stay lean and you don't care about maybe losing a little muscle, then maybe you can do a little bit more. But I would go moderately, like 3 to 4 days a week, and then probably 4 days a week of weight training. So that would be my recommendation. All right, I got one also comment here on my Apple podcast reviews. If you guys listen to our podcast on Apple iTunes, if you could go to their page and leave a comment, that would really help out our ratings here. This one was from Anthony in Great Britain. He said, "This is a fantastic podcast, the best on bodybuilding. The interviews are interesting, educational, and entertaining. Thank you for your hard work in putting these together for us. Anyone who is new to bodybuilding should subscribe and maybe even go back to the very beginning and listen through. There is much to learn and be inspired from. The readings from the articles are a brilliant add-on." All right. I'm glad people love those. "You are recording a golden time in bodybuilding history for future generations." Thank you. All right. Thank you, Anthony. Thanks for your comment all the way from Great Britain. I appreciate you listening to the show. All right. I think that's all I got, guys, for our opening. So here is our interview with Miss Charlotte Parker, who is the PR person for Arnold Schwarzenegger. And she also had some other ties to the bodybuilding world that she's going to talk about in our interview. And then stay tuned to the podcast right after we get done talking to Charlotte, because I will be reading a little section from the book Pumping Iron, the revised edition, about the sport and the art of bodybuilding in 1980. All right, here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special guest with me this week. Her name is Miss Charlotte Parker. Charlotte is an image specialist, and she was Arnold Schwarzenegger's PR person for the peak of his career. Charlotte, thanks for joining me.
Hi, John. I'm happy to be here.
All right. I'm happy you're here, too. Well, Charlotte, we always start with our guests at the beginning. So if you could tell us, like, how you got into public relations and how that all started.
Well, it's actually kind of interesting. I was in New York. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, but then I moved to New York for college.
Okay.
And then one of my very first jobs was working at Penthouse Magazine.
Oh, really?
Yes. I worked in the production department for a while. And then after that, at night, I started my own magazine.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And it became a cult magazine. It's called headmagazine.com.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, it's being relaunched. But in any case, after that, that went on for several years. And Then through a series of things that happened, I moved to Los Angeles.
Okay.
And my very first job, I was looking, you know, trying hard to enter a new career. And my first job was as director of public relations for the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, the Emmys.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So then after that, that lasted about a year or so. Then from there, I went to one of the top public relations firms. And then from there, I went to another.
Okay.
And then I was at Rogers & Cowan, which is a very big public relations firm.
Right. Okay.
And you want to know how I got to Arnold? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Basically? So what happened?
Were you interested in movies when you were younger?
Yeah. So basically, okay. Yeah. So here's what's going on. This firm, a lot of the very famous people work there, and most of them, most of the top PR people were interested in like the Oscar kind of pictures.
Okay.
Serious Oscar pictures. But I, from long time standing, have been an action fan.
Oh, action, really?
And sci-fi. That's my métier. I love it. Totally
okay.
into it. And then I said, do you mind if I work on this picture? Because, you know, nobody was really, you know, working on the, nobody was that excited at the firm about Conan the Destroyer.
Right.
But I was very
right.
excited about it. And I started working on it. So the first time I, so there I am working on this thing. And I'm pretty new at the firm. And I was young, still quite young.
Okay.
And I get, you know, I thought, well, it's time to get the star on the phone. So I get Arnold Schwarzenegger on the phone in Mexico.
Okay.
He had not met me. And the first thing he did was scream at me, bellowing, why is nobody working on this film? This big famous firm, you know, that
right.
I hired.
Right.
And I said, well, I am. And he said, okay, okay. And then I said, well, what do you want? And he said, what he wanted was all of the European covers. Now, he was very early on in understanding the importance of international.
Right.
But as it turns out, early on in my career at this firm, the first thing I did when they hired me to look for international PR.
Oh.
So yeah. So I was working. In fact, I was working on this. And so I kind of had a feeling about what was happening. I said, fine, you want me to get you these covers? He goes, yeah. So I went out and I got him every single cover. And then I got him, because I was new and excited and very excited about this. So I got him so much publicity that nobody could believe it.
Really?
Yeah. Even twice on the Tonight Show, I got him and Grace Jones on the Tonight Show.
Oh, no kidding. Wow. Rare,
which is really very rare that they take two people, you know?
Yeah. Now, did you know a lot about Arnold before you started working with
no.
him?
No.
Okay.
I didn't know anything.
Because I'm a body.
I didn't even meet him until the movie was over because he was shooting, you know, out of the country.
Okay. So when you met him, he was still shooting Conan the Destroyer in Mexico.
When I met him on the phone with this yelling at me and telling me what he wanted, and I said, okay,
right.
okay, I'll get you what you want.
Right.
Then afterward, I met him and he took me out to dinner.
Okay.
When we came, he took me out to dinner at the Palm. I remember that always.
Okay. Right.
And I was very excited and we talked about it and I told him, you know, this and so we continued. Then the next picture he did was The Terminator.
Okay.
So I remember.
I want to stop you there before we go.
Yeah, sure.
On Conan, where was Arnold's standing in the PR firm? Because they worked with a lot of Academy Award films and high prestige films. So what did they think of Arnold at that time when you started?
You know, I don't know what they thought. I mean, I think, you know, at a company, we love all our, you know, everybody loves all their clients. I don't think there's anything like that. I think the way that the things fell is that a lot of the people that they had working there were enamored by, you know, as I said, the big Oscar pictures
right.
and, you know, other people really into the music celebrities and corporate. And this was through an happenstance falling through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was not an exciting, you know, but it was exciting to me.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I was very, very excited about it. And, so he, you know, we went there, we took me to dinner and then
what did he say at dinner? What was his?
Oh, he asked me what I thought of the film and how it was and, you know, whatever. And you know, we just generally talked and it was like a nice meal. The Palm at that time was kind of a really hot place. And
yeah, I've heard of it.
It was really, you know, it was just getting to know, you know, he wanted to put the face to the phone.
Yeah.
And so that's how it started.
Did you like that movie, Conan the Destroyer?
You know, I as I said to him, I said, I thought you were great.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's really, you know, It was a funny thing. That film, Oliver Stone wanted to direct it, but nobody let him. Richard Fleischer directed it.
Right.
And it was fine.
Yeah.
It was not the greatest film of all time, but, you know, Arnold, you know, really pulled off another, you know, always, you know, the force of his personality was
very
powerful. And also the other people that were in it were very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they made the most of it.
I think it got a lot of criticism from the Conan fans because it wasn't as hardcore as the first one, right?
It was not.
Yeah.
So that was my first film, but I really, but the thing is that I pushed out the amount of publicity that I pushed out. I still have the report. It's like a foot thick, you know?
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so then the next picture was Terminator.
Okay. So that was
now, what happened was I read the script. And as I read the script, I was going, oh my God, this is the most incredible thing I've ever read. You have to understand, right. I'm a true sci-fi fan.
Right, right.
It blew my mind.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I want to represent this director who James Cameron,
right.
Wrote the film. And prior to this, he had only done Piranha, I think he'd done Piranha 3 or something. So, I said, this is incredible. This is just incredible. This film was amazing.
Yeah.
And I only had read the script, which blew my mind. But then I remember sitting there during the screening. We had they showed us the screening, you know, the people. I had probably my own screening of the film before. And I was so excited that I could barely keep myself in my seat. And I literally ran out and called Time Magazine. After I read this, and I said, this is the most amazing thing I have seen in a long time. And I remember telling people, I said, this guy, James Cameron, is the next Spielberg. I said, you better talk to him now because you're not going to be able to talk to him later. And I really, really believed in this thing. And I was like so hot on this that I remember Orion was releasing it.
Right.
And Arnold took me and he got a real kick out of this. I talked to Mike Medavoy at that time, who was the head of Orion. And I said, you've got to give this film more advertising. And Arnold was laughing. He loved the, you know, the fact that this girl was like telling the guy,
the head of Orion Pictures.
And do you remember that they made this poster that said Schwarzenegger Terminator, you know, underneath the Terminator.
Yeah.
So I was pushing for that. And I made them, I said, you give him a full page ad. And Arnold was laughing. He thought it was hilarious.
Right, right.
And yeah, then,
the book I read, they said that they were focusing more on, Orion Pictures was focusing more on Amadeus, which was their big Oscar.
Yes, they were. Yeah. Everybody focused on their Oscar pictures.
Yeah.
And I said, you don't understand. They did not understand, you know?
Right, right.
But I understood.
Right. Well, I remember seeing that movie when it came out, and there was no publicity about it. Like there was, I didn't really even know what it was about when I went to see it. Now I was blown away, and I was like, "Wow, Arnold was really a bad guy in that movie," you know?
Well, yeah, that's interesting because at first he was not scheduled to have the Terminator part. He was scheduled to have the other part.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
So when you first read the script, that was before they made the movie.
That was while they were making the movie, but I wasn't on the set, you know, or they had made the movie already and it was in they were editing. I don't know, whatever the exact timeline was, but I had not seen the movie.
Okay.
But they gave me the script to read.
Yeah.
And as I was reading the script, I was just so incredibly taken with it.
Yeah. It's an amazing movie. Even to this day, when I watch it, it's still an amazing movie.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, and Jim talked about how he was in a fever dream when he wrote it.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So had Arnold already decided to do the Terminator part when you were working with him, or that was
he was already the Terminator? Yeah. Already.
Okay. All right.
And through it was very odd because prior to that, like 5 minutes before that, I had done the Exterminator with.
Oh, really?
With Robert Gintey. So I was doing the Exterminator and the Terminator.
That's
but in any case, so I did the Terminator, and I also represented Jim Cameron, by the way.
Oh, you did?
And
okay.
Alan Hurd. Oh, yes.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yes, because I said, this guy's incredible. Incredible.
Yeah.
I have to represent the guy.
You're right on with that.
So I did. So I represented Jim, actually, and Gail for quite a few years prior after that. I also launched Jim's career, too, in terms of PR.
Yeah.
And so what was going on with Arnold is that I was very excited about him. You know, I thought... I said to him, and I literally said this, I said, I'm going to make you the biggest star in the world.
He had to love that.
He did. Well, he agreed that he belonged there.
Yeah,
I saw the vision. I saw it.
Yeah. So what did you see, Charlotte? What did you see when you saw Arnold? Like, what did you see that no one else was seeing?
I'll get to that.
Okay. All right.
I'll get to that. But what happened was I was actually in the film division.
Okay.
I was not representing him personally at that time.
Okay.
I was only representing the films.
The way that the firm was divided
was there were people who represented people personally, and there were people who represented people who you represented film, you represented television. Mm-hmm. Prior to this, I had represented television in a different firm, but I mean, I was representing film.
Okay.
And the films. So my client was the filmmakers, you know, and whoever was releasing the film.
Okay.
Anyway, one day I get called in to the guy, Paul Block. He was the head of the personality division. He calls me in and he says, listen, Charlotte, he says, Arnold Schwarzenegger has requested you to represent him personally.
Hmm.
And I thought, really? You know, I said, I was a very earnest, young person. I'm still pretty earnest, but in any case, I said, well, okay, fine. So then from then on, I was his personal publicist.
Okay.
Okay. Wow. So then, after that, he had only done this. He had done from me. He had done Conan, The Destroyer, and Terminator.
Okay.
He was doing Red Sonja in Italy, but I really didn't have too much to do with that one.
Okay.
So what happened was Joel Silver one day, I met him. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know who he is, quite a famous action producer.
Right.
And I met him and Larry Gordon, and Joel Silver was saying, I've got this picture that I really want Arnold to do. Can you help me?
Mm-hmm.
So I felt Arnold should be, at that time, he was still with, these independent, people. And I felt he should do a studio picture.
Okay.
So I was jumping up and down and I lobbied like crazy for him to do Commando.
Okay.
Commando was, Joel Silver was the producer, but that was a big studio picture. So I lobbied, like crazy, and he did Commando, and that turned out to be big.
Yeah. Now, when you say studio picture, so Conan the Barbarian, that wasn't a studio picture?
It was. But then he did that. But then he did
Conan the Destroyer.
Then he did Terminator.
Oh, okay. Terminator was a smaller movie.
Yeah, it was a smaller movie. And he was being handed smaller movies, like independent films.
Okay.
And that was not the vision that I had for him.
Right.
Despite the fact that that's what he was being offered through a variety of different things.
Yeah.
My vision for him was major A-list.
Yeah, right. Biggest star in the world.
Yeah, that's most my vision.
Okay.
And I, my ability to manifest my vision is pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and obviously he was someone who was completely prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want me to tell you what I thought of him, he has a charisma that is so astounding. Mm-hmm. When you're in his presence, he has something that I call an X factor.
Okay.
Okay. So I used to be with him all the time when he did his interviews.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in the room, or I scheduled them and I was in the room.
Yeah.
But I used to feel when I left him, when I would leave the room, I would feel like I could do anything. I could walk on water. I could accomplish anything.
Right.
Because he's a very inspiring person.
He is. Right. Right.
Can do kind of guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's so.
It's funny you say that, because when I would see him on like the Tonight Show or something, just that little burst of him on there, I'd be like, that's how I felt. I felt life affirming, Or if I see him,
very life affirming. I have to tell you that after he did the Tonight Show for the Terminator, he came back in and we dissected it.
Yeah.
He said, what do you think I did that worked or what didn't work? And so he really, he was someone I would say early on who understood the importance of publicity, of public relations, how to use it.
Right, right.
What to do with it. Not everyone had that understanding.
Right, right.
But well, aside.
I remember the story when his book, Education of a Bodybuilder, came out in 1977. Mm-hmm. I read this somewhere. I think it was his one of the stories or his autobiography or something. Mm-hmm. And he talked to the publishing company and they said, you know, well, we'll put you on this little book tour. And he goes, no, I want to go to every major city in the United States. So they booked it out. You know, he understood how important it was to go to all these cities and be there and publicize it himself. And I remember living in Chicago at the time and I would hear him on the radio, you know, and then he would be on the local television show, on the news, advertising it. And he would be in all the newspapers. So he really was a workhorse. He understood, like you said, the value of publicity.
He really, really, really did. Always. He always, and I think that made him very valuable too, to a lot of the people that he worked for, a lot of the studios and the few, because he was willing to do everything that it took. A lot of the very big stars at the time considered themselves, well, you know, I'm not going to do this or that, or I'm only going to do so much. But he gave it full force all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, he did Commando, then he did Raw Deal, then he did Predator.
Yeah.
And the various producers that he did it with, you know, were really, really good, and the directors, and then he did Predator, he did Running Man.
Yeah. So I'm guessing his standing in Hollywood must have really changed after Terminator, right? Because I think people only saw him as Conan the Barbarian. And then after he did Terminator, that was people must have saw him in a different role, right?
Well, I'll get to that too.
Okay.
George Linder produced Running Man, Keith Barish, you know, who was also a wonderful producer, who, by the way, then started Planet Hollywood.
Oh, really?
Okay. Robert Earl. And so that's another story. But in any case, Predator he did with Joel Silver.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did Red Heat. But at a certain point, what happened was that I said, I'm not really liking this image, you know, of the bodybuilders had an image of dumb jock kind of,
right.
You know, they're big muscle guys, but not a lot of brains and not a lot of, you know,
right.
It was the brawn, not particular brains. And I said, you know what? I don't like this image. So what I did was when I got him the cover of GQ, I insisted that they photograph him in a suit.
Mm-hmm.
And I had him wear suits. And then what I did is I don't know if you remember at a certain point in time when the thing shifted to what a brilliant financial mind he was.
Right, right.
Do you remember that? That was me. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because I started putting that out there. I did it because it was true.
Right, right.
But people weren't seeing that.
Right. They didn't know how smart he was.
They did not know how smart he was. They knew that he was strong and inspiring and whatever. What you also didn't know when you were, unless you were with him in a room or whatever, is how funny and how, I don't know, just the amount of, like you say, joie de vivre and mm-hmm. pure energy that emanated from the guy.
Right, right,
So that's what happened. That was the turning point, I feel, was when I started putting out the stuff about what a financial genius the guy is.
Right.
You know, and that sort of thing. And he is, I mean, there's no question about it, but I got them to do it that way. And then I kept having him be photographed, you know, in suits and talking about the finances. Mm-hmm. And that's when I think the switch came to the complete A-list.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always amazing. I'm a big fan of Arnold and I've read a lot of books about him and stuff, but I remember like when he said he was going to get into movies, and he's told this story a million times, about how all the agents in Hollywood made fun of him and said, you know, your name is too long and you have an accent and you have a big body and you'll never make it. But what I always really admired about Arnold was that he had this vision of himself as something different than that, you know, and he could see that and he believed in himself before anyone else did. And
I agree with that. And I think the key to success in a lucky way was finding me in a way.
Because
I saw that. I think prior to me, he was very, very frustrated that people were not seeing that. And there was no one willing to execute it who would have the ability to execute that vision that he had for himself.
Right.
But we were completely in sync. And I actually pushed that train to the degree that he allowed me to, you know?
Yeah. So why do you think you saw it, Charlotte, and no one else did?
Because I saw it and it was there. I mean, I mean,
you're good at what you do.
I'm good at what I do. And I like to think that I'm an insightful person who sees people.
Yeah.
And I saw it in the same way that I saw Jim Cameron's abilities.
Yeah. Right.
I picked a lot of them early, actually. Yeah,
really? Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Tom Cruise, Sean Penn. Yeah. I said, this guy's really good, you know?
Mm hmm. So with Arnold, you said he had the X factor and he obviously had the charisma.
That's what I call it. I believe he had an X factor. Yes.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you saw that and you saw the charisma and you saw something that he had that really wasn't being projected on the screen yet in the roles he was doing. Right.
Right. But then he also was willing to make fun of himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So after Red Heat, which was a wonderful film, which he did with a wonderful Russian actor, Oleg Vidov, who was like the Robert Redford of Russia, played his partner, his Russian partner. I mean, he's a wonderful actor as well. And then he did Twins with Ivan Reitman.
Right.
I mean, you know, that he was willing to, you know, to make fun of himself there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were throwing in little one-liners here and there throughout all his movies. Was that your idea too, or
that was not me. That was him.
That was him. Okay, yeah. Because mm-hmm. It took a while before they were able to do a straight comedy like Red Heat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Red Heat was an adventure in Moscow. Bodybuilding is very big in Russia.
Yeah.
That's another story.
Oh, really?
Okay. We did Total Recall, Kindergarten Cop, which was also a lot of humor in it.
Yeah.
And then T2. Mm-hmm. Right after T2, Jim Cameron came up to me at the screening and he said, how cool do I make your guy look? I said, very, very cool. You know, I don't know if you remember T2.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think was the apex of his movie career? Do you think it was Terminator 2?
Yes, because right after that, he did Last Action Hero. Because he was so high up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how it is in a lot of these things. When you're that big, they want to bring you down.
Right, right.
The Last Action Hero wasn't that happy a situation.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a wonderful film, but the press, you know, went with things that weren't true and they, you know, whatever. Anyway, they panned it. Then he did True Lies.
Mm-hmm. Great film. I love that
Great
one.
Film. Then Junior, which was hilarious.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty much when, you know, we parted ways after that.
Okay. All right.
But in the meanwhile, just so you know, what Arnold did was during this time, he would have me go to all the various bodybuilding publishers.
Okay.
And say, I want the cover to be, he wanted the cover of all the bodybuilding magazines to go when his film, you know, went out. So he wanted them coordinated because everybody wanted, all the bodybuilding magazines wanted Arnold on the cover, right?
Right, sure, yeah.
So I went to all of them and they were all very, very nice, as mm-hmm. you can imagine.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I met Joe Weider.
Okay.
So I went there, I went to Joe Weider and I said, you know, hey, Arnold would like the cover for, you know, whatever it was, literally every single film I would go to Joe Weider.
Right.
Okay. And Joe was, you know, really nice about it. But over time, Joe and I built a friendship and a relationship.
Uh-huh.
And then I ended up representing Joe Weider and the Weider family. And I still do, by the way.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Yes, still do. Joe and Betty Weider. Betty Weider, who is the most beautiful, lovely person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And the entire Weider family, who, you know, who is absolutely brilliant. The family is incredible.
Okay. So what are you doing for them, Charlotte?
They have a variety of different things. I mean, his, you know, Eric Weider took over the company brilliantly.
Okay.
And Eric is a tremendously sophisticated and very smart and very, very, very nice person, mm-hmm. but brilliant.
Right.
And took over, you know, the supplements, took over everything. And also he has quite a highly regarded art gallery, Gallery 19C in Beverly Hills that represents 19th century, mostly French art. But
okay.
I mean, the guy's amazing. He ran a publishing company of history magazines. At a certain point, you know, after that, I mean, obviously, so Joe is obviously a brilliant genius in the world of bodybuilding.
Yeah.
No question. Right. But through Arnold, I met basically all of the lights and greats of bodybuilding. And I remember when, and in fact, during this time, as you might recall, Arnold became the,
President's Council of Physical Fitness.
Right. He was the chairman of the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports. Right. And, and he said, I'm going to visit every single state.
Right.
I mean, only Arnold would do such a thing,
right,
you know?
Right.
I'm going to visit them. I mean, I'm going to visit them in 24 hours. You know what I mean? But not, I mean, there's no rest for the guy. He's like, not. And so I visited many of them with him.
Oh, really?
Okay. I met George and Barbara Bush with him. So it was, he did a tremendous job. I don't think they've had such a visible great one.
No. You never even hear who's running that anymore, if they still have that position.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they do. They have it.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I remember they did the big workout on the White House lawn and they had all those stars there and George and Barbara Bush were there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't he also taking his Gulfstream jet that he got in the deal with Terminator 2? Wasn't it also?
Yeah, in fact, about the bodybuilding, Rob Wilkins, who's a very good friend of ours and the Weeders, is a member of that council now.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's wonderful.
Okay.
He's a veteran and absolutely.
Yeah, I know Rob. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's a member of the council and he does a great job.
Okay. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And then you also got to work with Joe Gold as well, right?
Yes. So what happened there was, so you know Joe Gold, the famous Joe Gold with Gold's Gym, right? He built that. But then for some reason, I don't know exactly, can't remember the reason, he left to go to the Merchant Marine.
Right.
Okay. Right. And, you know, Joe Gold from way back was one of Mae West's, you know.
Yeah.
Strong men and a very attractive. Joe came back and he wanted to launch the gym, but he had already sold his name.
Right.
So Arnold, who was very, very close to Joe, said, Charlotte, I want you to help me. I want you to launch World Gym.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to call it World Gym. And then it said World Gym operated by Joe Gold.
Okay.
So Arnold and Joe, my partner, Joel Parker, and me, mm-hmm. we launched World Gym for him. The big one, you know, on Venice. And it was a huge party with all these stars and everything. And that's how it got started. Okay. And I used to go there all the time, I would see Joe and Eddie Giuliani and I still have all my, like, you know, the sweatshirts with the gorilla on the front the back.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, it was just really, really great. And, so I would go there and that's how that happened. Yeah. There was something else that popped into my head that I wanted to talk about. I'm trying to remember what it was, but go ahead.
So you got to know a little bit of the bodybuilding world then, right? Through Joe.
Oh, very much so.
Joe Gold.
Very much so. I knew the bodybuilding world very much.
Yeah. Did you go to a lot of the competitions? Did you go to the Arnold Classic?
Yes. That's what it was that, you know, Joel and I, we launched the Arnold Classic for Arnold.
You did? Wow.
Oh, yes.
Kidding.
Yes.
Wow.
Arnold said, you know, I want to have a contest, you know. You have to understand that Arnold, movie star that he is a bodybuilder at heart.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
He really, really is.
Yeah.
And so it's not like some guys who might use it as a stepping stone and then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
No, he is a true through and through bodybuilder.
Yeah.
So he wanted to launch a contest because he was really into it.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a friend.
Jim Lorimer?
Yes, Jim Lorimer.
Okay.
Jim Lorimer, brilliant guy.
Yeah, great guy.
Absolutely brilliant. And worked for a big insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives in Columbus, still does.
Right.
And so that's why they have it in Columbus, because Jim lived there.
Right.
Bob Lorimer has now taken it over.
Mm-hmm. His son, right.
But that's what was going on there. And we worked on it with Richard Neuberger, who was there, and Richard Neustadt, I mean, who was in Columbus.
Okay.
And so Joel and I launched that. Now, in the meanwhile, Joel was representing the Olympia in Las Vegas.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Oh, yes. Wow. Yes. So we were in this thing coming and going.
Right. Yeah.
And then I remember the day, now when Arnold became governor.
Yeah.
He did one thing that was really amazing. He did Joe Weider Day in Sacramento. I don't know if you're aware of it or you
remember that now. Now that you mentioned it, I remember that.
That was a big deal. That was like every major bodybuilder.
Yeah. Yeah.
Joe and Betty, who are so lovely and generous.
Yeah.
We flew people up and they took care of them. And it was just an incredible, incredible day of celebration of Joe Weider.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's amazing.
And in fact, many years later when Joe passed, I actually worked on the memorial with Arnold. It was me and Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
We put together the big memorial for Joe.
Okay. Wow.
And Arnold was extremely generous and couldn't do enough.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do enough for Joe.
Yeah.
And he's still very, very close to Betty.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
Oh, very close. Yes.
Yeah. He, no matter how big he got, he always gave credit to Joe Weider for bringing him over here, you know, bringing him to America.
Yeah. Joe, listen, talk about loving bodybuilding as much as anyone in the world. That was Joe Weider for you.
Yeah. Right.
Joe Weider loved bodybuilding. Joe Weider's story is incredible too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Joe was a kid in Montreal, skinny kid.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he would suffer, you know, a lot of the anti-Semitic slurs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, you know, he got this magazine just like Arnold did, you know, you know, right?
Yeah.
When he saw Rich Park.
Rich Park.
You know, Joe kind of happened against this, you know, earlier. It was earlier, obviously, and in Montreal.
Yeah, 20s, yeah.
Yeah. And he said, wait a minute, I can do this. So what he did is he ordered, you know, he tried to order this stuff and he didn't have hardly any money. So he would pay the guy 50 cents a week, you know, and he was delivering groceries on a little wagon, you know, and he'd give most of the money to his parents.
Right.
And of course, his brother, Ben Weider, who, of course, was the head of the IFBB and a brilliant businessman, Ben was as well.
Yeah.
And so Joe, he finally got these weights. And once he got into these weights, he could not believe how wonderful the experience was and what it did for his body.
Yeah.
So it was like as though he found, you know, the meaning of life, religion, and he wanted to share it.
Right, right.
He wanted to share it. That's really where Joe came from. He said, this is so great. Everybody needs to know how great this is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was truly passionate about it in his heart and soul, yeah.
I don't know if you ever saw Joe. In 1950, Joe wrote, I predict.
Mm-hmm.
I could go grab it if you wanted.
Sure,
read them.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe wrote these in 1950.
Okay.
I predict that civilization will speed up in every phase and that the stresses and strains on mankind will continue to increase. I predict the resulting increase in mental and physical illness will force the world to recognize the importance of systematic exercise and physical activities. You know, when Joe was doing this, nobody was working out.
No, no way.
Nobody was working out.
Not in 1950.
Betty said when she was modeling, and you know, Betty was quite the famous model.
Yeah.
She actually early on also, you know, worked out very early with you know, weights to help strengthen her because she was, you know, a skinny kid and she wanted to have strength and a brilliant woman as well as beautiful.
Yeah.
But she said that what they did when she would like do ads for stockings, they would hoist her up on a hoist so that her calf muscles wouldn't show.
Really?
Yeah. So, yeah. And Joe told me, you know, he said that, you know, he wanted, you know, that they were afraid that football players and baseball players would become too muscle bound.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Now it's de rigueur. Now everyone must train.
Everybody do it. Yeah. Right.
But before, when Joe was doing this, it was unheard of.
Right. Right.
So number three was, I predict that bodybuilding will become the chief form of systematic exercise and physical activity, and that it will come to be looked upon as one of the greatest forces in the field of preventative medicine.
Hmm.
I mean, he really was a prescient guy, you know?
Right, right.
I predict that a full realization of the importance of muscular development will sweep the world and the sport of bodybuilding will grow. I predict the basics of good bodybuilding, which include a balanced diet, adequate sleep, plenty of fresh air, ample sunshine, and regular workouts will become the basics of living. Now, is that ridiculous? I mean, that's that was ridiculous. Like not thought about then.
Right, right.
I predict that bodybuilding will become the stepping stone to every other sport, that the art of relaxation, one of the fundamentals of bodybuilding, will become more and more important as tensions increase. That'll spread to every corner of the world. that those who practice this will live healthier and happier lives and will become one of the greatest forces in existence. But that was Joe Weider for you.
Yeah.
Someone who, you know, believed in it. And so that's how his magazine started. It was just people started asking him things like, you know, because he would go to certain competitions. So he would mimeograph these things in his kitchen.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how he started, you know, with physical, you know, the thing. And he would mimeograph it, and then it became more and more important. And then, you know, the story of how he wanted to get it published, and he would go in, and he was this kid, and the publisher said, "Mr. Weider," he said, I'm waiting to talk to your father." He said, "No, I'm Mr. Weider." And so anyway, that, you know, the stories of all of this.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Did you see that movie Bigger that came out a couple of years
ago? Of course.
Yeah. What'd you think of that?
I loved it.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know Dan Solomon who helped get that whole thing.
Yes.
Going.
And also another wonderful producer.
Yeah. You want to talk a little bit, Charlotte, about Arnold's relationship with Stallone? Because they had kind of a contentious relationship in the, you know.
Okay. So here's what happened there.
Because they're good friends now, right? I mean, they're
now good. They're very good friends.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's what happened. Arnold, normally, you know, I would give him recommendations of what to do and what not to do.
Okay.
You know, in other words, you know, in terms of publicity, because I was an expert, right?
Yeah.
I had very good instincts.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, the interviewer, you know, for Playboy, they wanted to do that famous Playboy interview.
Right.
So this woman, she came to Arnold and said, "Let's not get the publicist involved."
Hmm.
And I said, "Please don't do this." I said, "Let me be there at the meeting.
Okay.
Let me be part of it because, you know, I was there. I mean, look, the guy's a professional. Arnold's a brilliant guy and a smart guy, but everybody could use some additional looking out for, right?
Yeah, backup, right, right.
Right. And I knew him inside out and I knew everything. And, but she talked him into it and she said, you know, let's not get the publicists involved here. Just do it with me. And I begged him not to do that.
Right.
But he did it. And then he said that he told her things off the record.
Mm-hmm.
His opinion. I can't even remember exactly what it was that he said.
Right.
Something about Stallone, you know? And he claimed that it was off the record and she claimed it wasn't.
Okay.
So she published it and then the rest, that's where the feud started.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was nothing I could do.
Right.
At that point.
So if you would have been there, you would have told them not to say that at all, right? Don't say anything.
If I had been there, I don't know what I would have done in the moment.
Yeah.
But at least somebody would have been a witness to say it was off the record at least.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right.
You see what I mean?
Right. Right.
I may have said to her, you know, I may have said, let's not go there.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, cause usually I did not participate in these things. I was just in the back unless I heard something that bothered me.
Right. Right.
And this would have probably bothered me, you know?
Yeah.
And if he had said off the record, then I would have double checked with her and made sure that it was off the record.
Yeah. Yeah. You cause know, what I read is what, when they did those Playboy interviews, I read that the reporters would come in for several days and then the subject, the star would become so comfortable with the reporter that they would start to divulge stuff that they probably wouldn't do if it was just like a 1 hour interview or something.
Right. They would look for things. And my job was to prevent that.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Not that there was any big secrets that he had or any big whatevers that he had, but that people say things in unguarded moments that they don't necessarily want on the front page of the New York Times, you know?
Yeah. Was there any damage after that interview came out?
I wouldn't say there was damage. I would say that there was a certain rift in their relationship.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because at the beginning, I would always marry him up. I would make sure that before he was big, I would only talk about him, you know, in relation to other big stars. I would constantly put him in that group. And that's another one of my methods of getting
him. Right. I read that
in that way. Yeah. But once he was in that group, I don't think that he would have wanted, you know, a rift with him.
Right.
And they did ultimately make up because they're both, you know, brilliant, incredible people, but very, very different people.
Yeah. did Arnold really feel that way about Stallone when they were rivals? Because I know he was kind of like that with his bodybuilding rivals. You know, he would try to, you know, do psychological games with them and try to psych them out in order to get an advantage.
You know, I don't think that he gave a tremendous amount of thought to, I mean, I think, you know how he is. He's he likes to poke his rivals.
Right.
You know,
right.
He's a poker, you know, he right, likes to, right. To poke people and get them riled up. But I don't think there was any deep feelings. I'm sure he very much respected, you know, everything that Stallone did. Who wouldn't?
Yeah.
But I think that he was, you know how it is. And he may have known, I don't know. I can't remember what it was about, but I don't think he had any disdain for him. He may have said things that he, you know, would rather not have said. I don't think necessarily things that he may have known or felt, or I don't know.
Yeah.
In the moment, you know,
because they were rivals.
They not wanted to have divulged.
Yeah. They were both in the same genre. They were both making the action movies. They were the two top guys at the time.
Right. But I mean, I think that there was something there that he said that was I can't remember exactly what it was anymore. But it was
he was talking about his personality, how he's kind of phony and he tries to be like Arnold. He's working out hard in the gym and things like that.
Yeah, I don't remember. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
I can't remember what specifically it was anymore, but yeah. But I know that whatever it was because we were in Cannes. Then we all went to the Cannes Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all there. He was there. Stallone was there. It was very interesting.
Right.
You know, we all stayed at the same hotel, by the way.
Yeah.
The Ducap, which is where all the big stars stayed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was very interesting, you know, it was very,
very tense.
It was tense. And I think that we tried to get it was then that we put together a photo session of the two of them together.
Okay.
Cause he was represented at the same firm.
Oh, really?
But at that time, I went on my own at that point. I have my own firm after that for, you know, quite a long time after that.
Okay.
I represented Arnold and Jim Cameron and John Davis and a lot of other people that we did on our own. And Joel worked on the Olympia and we did the Weeders and, you know, we had our own.
Yeah.
We broke off from them quite a while, you know, much, much earlier than that.
Yeah. Did you recommend to Arnold that he should do a movie with Stallone at that time when they were both big stars?
No, that wasn't, that didn't come up and he didn't ask me, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think since then they're buddies now.
Yeah, I know.
You know, Stallone came up for Joe Weider Day.
Yeah.
Because Arnold asked him to.
Yeah, he had Arnold in the Expendables and they're
good. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Stallone's a brilliant guy. You know, he wrote those movies. Yeah. But they're very, very different as people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you with Arnold when that controversial book came out from Wendy Lee?
Yes, very much so. Yes.
Unauthorized biography.
I really was. I was right in the middle of that.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Famously so.
Mm-hmm.
Famously so.
So I'm sure you had to do a lot of work with all the people he interviewed with, right? Because he didn't want to talk about that book.
Yes, I was right in the middle of that. And I did. I talked to people at the Cannes Film Festival. I didn't want them talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't want it to become a thing. Because I knew that he wasn't like that. I'm Jewish.
Right.
You know, and if I felt that there was anything there, believe me, you know, my parents are Holocaust survivors.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not gonna, you know, I mean, so many of us around him, you know, right. I mean, if I felt there was any shred of truth to that.
Yeah.
But it is true that his father, you know, did belong to the Nazi party.
Right.
His father was
a
policeman.
Right.
You know, a lot of the Austrians, you know, in that time were, you know, he talked about his father as a rough guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and then he voluntarily did a fundraiser for the, you know, Simon Wiesenthal Museum, where he was one of the first guys to raise $1 million for them. He did a big thing.
Wow. Yeah.
That was something he wanted to do. It wasn't something he did because he had to. He wanted it. It's just not him.
Yeah.
You know,
Joe Weider was Jewish also.
Hmm?
Joe Weider was Jewish also.
Very much so, yes.
Right.
So, but he's not that kind of a guy at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and but it is true that his father did do those things and
right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, I like how you said you called it marrying him up. So when he was working his way up the Hollywood ladder and he was going to these events and stuff, you would have him take pictures with bigger stars than him.
Yes, and I always mentioned him in the same breath as those people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I mean, like his good friend Albert Busek. You know, do you know Albert?
Sure, yeah.
He's an absolute, you know, giant in Europe and somebody who I love very much.
Yeah.
And, you know, Albert's father too, you know, and Albert completely divorced himself from that. Albert is one of the sweetest, most loving, most also brilliant people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Arnold would do these events where he'd have to walk down where, you know, where they have all the reporters along the street and he has to walk down. So you would get there ahead of him, right? Yeah.
I would always go right ahead of him and I would pre-interview everyone.
Right.
Before he came down.
Right.
So it was always easy as pie for him to come down.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Arnold, I got all the people all ready.
He was a publicity machine. You know, every time the movie came out, he would just go out and all the talk shows and he would talk about the movie. I notice a lot when I'm watching TV and I see various actors, especially today when they're on and they're there to promote a movie, they don't even talk about the movie. They'll talk about nonsense, you know, where Arnold would always get to it. And he would always bring in the movie into the conversation.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Arnold was hilarious. You could say, you know, it's nice weather today. And he would say, you know, the weather in my movie was so nice.
Right.
Didn't matter what they said, you know?
I remember I saw an interview with Jim Belushi when they were talking about Red Heat and then that scene where they're in the bus and they're running through Chicago and they're knocking over all these monuments and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, Arnold's talking about how they were driving through Chicago and they're knocking over all these monuments. And Jim Belushi was like, in reality, we were in Hollywood and they were just making the bus go like this. You know, we weren't in Chicago at all. We weren't driving.
I was in Chicago with Arnold during that.
Yeah.
I still remember we went into a bakery. He wanted to get something, a cookie or something. Uh-huh. And we went in and everybody was so excited that he came in and he had to sign all these bags. But that's the thing about, you know, he was very, very nice to everyone.
Right. Well, he loves being in the limelight, right? He loves being a star.
You know, I think that's a bargain that you make.
Yeah.
You know, when you become a star, you know, if you don't want to be recognized on the street.
Yeah.
Then don't be a movie star.
Right. Well, that's what he wanted, though, from the beginning of his career, right? When he got into movies, he wanted to be the number one star. That's what he saw of himself.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is, he had what it took to back it up.
Yeah.
In terms of, he had star power.
Yeah.
And I saw that.
Right. So when you started working with him after Conan the Destroyer, you saw that he had the potential to be the biggest box office star in the action genre.
I believe that with all my heart. And I said, I'm going to make it so.
So you
and
saw,
I did.
You saw
I had the vision.
Charisma. Yeah. Yeah. The physique, the charisma, everything. You knew he could make it.
I just felt he had it.
Yeah.
I felt he had what it took. I wouldn't have said that to someone who I didn't feel that had what it took.
Right. Right.
You know, other people have other things, you know, going for them. And those things are also wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I saw that for him and I saw that there was a path directly there that I felt I could take. I just knew it.
Yeah.
And I knew that Jim Cameron was going to be one of the biggest directors in the world. I knew it. And the guy had directed Piranha 3 prior to this.
Right, right.
So I saw it.
Well, it's kind of luck or fate or whatever that him and Jim got together right at the peak, right at the beginning of their careers, really, right?
Right. And I was right there.
Right. And then they had you to publicize them.
Right. And I think it was a very, you know, fortuitous, you know, grouping of people. I mean, they had the talent. I mean, Jim was an amazing, brilliant. I just read the thing and I said, I don't care. I'd not seen him. I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know how old he was. I just had read a bio that he wrote about himself. And I read the movie and I said, I'm all in for this guy.
Right.
All in for Jim Cameron, whoever he is. I'm all in for this guy.
Right. Yeah.
And I worked on Gail Ann Hurd too, who he was married to at that time as a producer. And she became quite the big producer after that. I believed in her too.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
And it also was a great turn of events too, that it all happened in the 80s when you had the Reagan era and then you had all the sci-fi movies and all the action movies, right? That was the era of the action movies.
Right. So that's what it was. I was there at this place where everybody was really into these, you know, Oscar, you know, things rock and roll things. And I'm the one there thinking I love action sci-fi.
Right, right.
And there I was. And so,
you're in the right spot, right.
Right.
Because if this would have happened in 1970 or 1974 instead of 1984, it probably wouldn't have taken off like that.
Right. It was just one of those things where you were in the, everybody was in the right place at the right time for that thing to happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, Charlotte, you're still working now then? You're still in the public relations business?
Yes, I'm still in the public relations business. I still do image consulting, and I'm also relaunching my publication, headmagazine.com.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah. Yep, I still am.
So what's that about? It.
In other words, I did this before I got into public relations.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was actually a cult figure in the,
late 70s.
Yes.
No kidding.
I was the guest of honor at the International Hallucinogenic Mushroom Conference.
Okay.
Along with R. Gordon Wasser, who was the creator of LSD.
Okay. So that's what the magazine's about, head.com. It's about
It's not head.com. It's headmagazine.com.
Headmagazine.com. Okay.
But that's okay. Head.com is tennis.
Okay.
It's about, at that time, it was about marijuana and counterculture.
Okay.
You know, pop culture. Now it's about cannabis and pop culture and, you know, everything around, you know, all those things now.
Okay. All right. Cool.
I relaunched my iconic brand.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going back to your roots.
But yes, I still also got the public relations business along with Joel Parker.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Joel does the Olympia?
Not anymore, but he did for, you know, quite a few years. He worked on it.
Okay.
He was the public relations guy. But, you know, once David,
Parker.
You know, David bought it. I actually worked with David briefly.
Okay.
Not on that, but on some other things. But then, then, you know, it's all different now.
Yeah.
And Dan Solomon's a great guy. He's doing an amazing job.
He's doing a great job. Yeah.
Wonderful person.
Yeah.
He's a smart guy.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, very, very much so.
Mm-hmm. You're all in the same state there.
Yeah. Yeah. Florida's
you
a state.
Him?
Yeah. And what are you doing for Betty Weider now as far as publicity?
Betty? Betty has a website. She also, you know, she devotes herself to Joe's legacy.
Okay. Okay.
You know, Joe's website and Joe with all the things that Joe does. And Betty's a very smart person herself. You know, she has quite a lot of, you know, she has her own businesses in real estate that she deals with. And she is one of the smartest, kindest.
Yeah.
And still very beautiful.
Yeah, she is. Yeah.
Inside and out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. All right, Charlotte. Well, thank you for joining me on the show. This was great for me because I'm a big Arnold fan and I've read about you in the autobiography or his biographies, I should say, not his autobiography. So I wanted to talk to you and find out how you did the magic with Arnold in the movies and making him a star.
Well, I hope that it helped to some degree. And it was very nice to talk to you too, John.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you for joining me.
Pleasure.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you guys for all your emails. Again, if you want to email me, just do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. Before we go, I do want to read this chapter in the book Pumping Iron, written, of course, by Charles Gaines. And it's about the sport and the art of bodybuilding in 1980. It says, when George Butler and I set out in the summer and fall of 1980 to determine what had happened in bodybuilding since we first looked into it, we thought we had two separate jobs. To identify and characterize the new forces and people in the sport by getting onto the contest circuit again, and to track down the people and forces depicted in the original Pumping Iron and find out what happened to them. To our surprise, the jobs turned out to be the same. In order to get acquainted with the new competitors, to see how competition and organizational structure had changed, and to learn exactly what changes have been wrought in the sport and the art, George and I went to two competitions together and one each separately. We also went to gyms, old and new, and to equipment and nutritional product manufacturers. And everywhere we went, though we found the landscape distinctly altered and more populated, we kept finding the same people and forces controlling it that we had found in 1972. Over the past 8 years, we learned bodybuilding had grown like a glacier, broadening at the base while remaining essentially unchanged at the top. Everything and nothing was different.
Joe and Ben Weider still called the shots in marketing and competitive organization, respectively. Ed Corney was still the best poser, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, the best bodybuilder alive. Arnold proved that he was this that year by emerging from a five-year retirement and winning a controversial Mr. Olympia title in Sydney, Australia, his seventh. By way of further making the point that nothing has really changed, Franco Colombo will probably try for the title next year, and he will very likely take it, as he did in 1976 following Arnold's retirement. As with Arnold and bodybuilding in general, much is different with Franco since 1972. He is a chiropractor now with a successful practice. He is a veteran TV personality and star of a series of television commercials. And he is a millionaire, yet much remains the same. He is still the undisputed clown prince of bodybuilding, its freest and blithiest spirit, its strongest practitioner, and the best small man in the business. Even Sergio Oliva, the great Cuban bodybuilder who won the Olympia title in 67, 68, and 69, has recently lumbered back into competition and is presently capable, I am told, of beating anyone. Think about it and try to come up with another sport in which the same three men, four with Frank Zane, who was Mr. Universe in 1968 and Mr. Olympia in 77, 78, and 79, who were the best 11 years ago and are still the best whenever they choose to compete. But it isn't only as competitors that the same old people continue in evidence in bodybuilding, but as teachers of expensive seminars, contest promoters and judges, and salesmen of their own products, wearing a variety of the new bodybuilding suits and sometimes two or three at once. As I've mentioned separately and together, George Butler and I went to four contests this summer and fall. At one or more of them, we saw practically every bodybuilder dealt with in the original edition of this book, with two notable exceptions: Serge Noubre, who has taken his muscles and gone home to France, and Lou Ferrigno, who has hulked out of the sport and into serial TV. Of the four major characters in the original book, Arnold was at three of the contests, twice as a promoter and once as a competitor. Ed Corney was also at three, once to sell his goods and twice as a competitor. Franco was at two, giving a seminar and selling his products at one and supporting Arnold and looking over the competition for next year at the other. And Mike Katz was at three, to produce, to judge, and hold a seminar, and to compete. It was wonderful having these old competitors and friends everywhere we went, performing a variety of roles. It provided us with familiar access to what was going on, as well as informed, often wry, and rarely objective evaluations of it. It brought our jobs together and allowed us to see the old and the new side by side and through each other. Good perspectives from which to report the state of the sport and art at once radically altered and unchanged after 8 years. The first contest we went to was the Best in New England Bodybuilding Championships, held in Connecticut at the Hamden High School Auditorium on a Saturday in the middle of August. It was produced by Mike Katz. In size and feel, it was not unlike Ed Jubenville's annual Mr. East Coast contest in Holyoke, Massachusetts, which is described in the text of this book and was the first bodybuilding competition George and I went to together. Some of the competitors we met at that first contest were in Mike's 8 years later, and one of them won second place. Ed Jubenville was also there as a head judge. This was an AAU contest. Back in 1972, the AAU was, along with the IFBB, NABBA, and the WBBG, one of four separate sanctioning organizations for bodybuilding competition, each of which worked against the others, creating for years a chaos of mutually exclusive procedures and similarly named titles. Since then, and probably the single most important stride bodybuilding has taken in this country, the AAU has become the American affiliate of the IFBB. There is still fractionalism and still some displeasure with the present organizational state of things. Shortly after Mike Katz's contest, Ed Jubenville, Tom Miniacello, and Harold Gibson, all contest promoters, split off from the AAU-IFBB and revived an organization called the Amateur Federation of American Bodybuilders, which they describe as an alternative to exploitation, an organization owing allegiance to no commercial interest. But essentially, Ben Weider has accomplished what he set out in 1946 to do. He and his IFBB have taken over American bodybuilding, and by and large, American bodybuilding is the better for it. Maybe 150 people paid $5 apiece to watch the prejudging of Mike's contest, and that night for the show, he filled the 500-seat house. In 1972, he would have been lucky to have 150 people at the show, and nobody but a few girlfriends and parents would have paid $5 to watch the prejudging. Other things were different as well. In 72, the contest would probably have been held at a YMCA gym under lights strung on a basketball rim. This year, it was produced by a local theater department in a large, comfortable auditorium on a professionally lit stage to piped-in music. Mike Katz was on stage when we came in at a microphone, explaining the prejudging to the audience. His hair was longer than in 72. He was lighter and had grown a mustache. But otherwise, he hadn't changed. The pigeon chest, the slow, stiff head movements, the genuineness and gravity he projects were all still right up there at the microphone. George and I sat down and watched the prejudging, not expecting much from this small regional competition. As it happened, any one of the top five finishers at Mike Katz's contest could probably have won the Mr. America title in 1972. The biggest change of all in bodybuilding over the past 8 years is the amazing upgrading of physiques at the lower levels of competition. The Mr. Olympia contest may have remained fairly static, dominated every year by the same people, but regional competition everywhere in this country has come a long, long way. The fact is that while there may be as few great active bodybuilders now as there were in 1972, there are many more good ones. Take Lem Archambault, for example, a bodybuilder George and I had first seen 8 years ago in Holyoke. In 1972, Archambault was a mid-league competitor with skinny legs, good lats, and no chest, who seemed destined to go on placing fourth at regional competitions for as long as he competed. This year, though he only took second place in Katz's small New England contest, he won his weight division at Schwarzenegger's Mr. International competition with a field of 27 bodybuilders from 10 countries, and he beat out Dale Adrian, the AAU Mr. America of 1975, in doing so. What the hell happened, you might wonder, to Len Archambault? Well, muscularity happened to him, as it did to hundreds of other bodybuilders between 1972 and the present. In 72, in any contest but the America, Universe, or Olympia, the winner would almost always be a brute with big, smooth muscles or a little gymnast type with cuts but no mass. Neither of these guys would win a Mr. South Hartford contest now because everybody else, it seems, has got muscularity, which is a combination of both size and clarity of the muscles. Everybody is both big and ripped, and anything less than that combination won't win you much. There are a number of reasons why this is now so and why it wasn't in 72, but mostly it has to do with the fact that those 8 years coincided with an unprecedented national interest in education in the body, as a result of which bodybuilders are infinitely more sophisticated about training, diet, and the use of drugs now than they were in 72. They train harder than they did then and faster, bombing as Arnold taught them how to do in his mail order courses and magazine articles, by doing a lot of repetitions with heavy weights and resting as little as possible. They've also learned since 72 that aerobic exercise, such as running and cycling, is the best way to build stamina for heavier, faster workouts, as well as being the best method for burning off stored fat and thus for polishing muscularity just before a contest. As for diet, it used to be thought that the only way to eat for a contest was first a lot and then a little, to bulk up as much as 20 or 30% more than what you wanted your weight to be for a contest, and then cut back down. That is not thought anymore. Now it is known that you lose as much muscle as fat that way. Bodybuilders now stay on high protein, medium to low carbohydrate diets most of the time, keeping within 5 to 10% of their contest weights, and they cut back on calories just before a contest. In line with that pattern, there's also been a move away from ingesting the 400 to 500 grams of protein a day to something more like 1 gram per pound of body weight. The daily use of pounds of vitamin and mineral supplements is out too now, though liver-enhancing substances such as choline and lecithin are still being widely and heavily used, according to John Balick, one of the top non-professional nutrition and drug experts in bodybuilding, as are potassium and certain glandular concentrates, among them a portion of gorilla glands said to be favored by a well-known West Coast bodybuilder. The use of steroids, too, has changed considerably since 1972, and that change has had as much to do with anything with the new muscularity. Oral steroids such as Dianabol and Anavar used to be employed, often in massive doses, primarily to gain weight, but those drugs, it was found, changed electrolyte balances in the body, causing it to retain water, bloating it, and smoothing the muscles. Bodybuilders are now using steroids not as much to grow, but as to hold on to the muscle during the period right before a contest when they are cutting back on calories. They are using lower dosages, say 1 cc a week spread over a number of days, as opposed to 3 or 4 cc's, and they are using injectable slow-acting steroids such as Primobol and acetate, a German product, or its American counterpart, Decadrobalin, which do not cause the body to retain water. Great bodybuilders are still rare because greatness in the sport and art requires the right genes, or as Arnold Schwarzenegger has put it, the right choice of parents, in addition to everything else. But with all the better training, better diet, and smarter use of drugs, there is a lot of muscularity around now. Muscularity makes for good bodybuilders, ones that are fun to watch. And there are a lot of them around, too, as was evident in Mike Katz's contest. The contest had 2 classes, under 175 pounds and over, and in each, there were 3 or 4 competitors in superb shape with good posing routines. Archambault, Skip Robinson, Pat Hayes, Craig Cole, a professional wrestler named Ivan Putski, and the winner, a beautifully chiseled black bodybuilder named Ron Magnum. The prejudging was well-staged, smooth, and polished, and when it was over, I went backstage to congratulate Mike Katz. All right. I'll end it there because it's kind of a long chapter, of course, but maybe we'll get back to that chapter in the future. All right, guys, that's all I got. Hope you enjoyed the interview with Charlotte Parker. We'll be back next week for an interview with Glenn Kinnear, 1986 AAU Mr. America, and Larry Bernstein, who was 1983 short class winner of the Mr. America and Mr. World. I got both these guys to sit down together, two old friends of mine from Chicago, and we are going to talk some old school bodybuilding in Chicago next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, guys, train hard, stay safe out there, and we'll see you next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Take care.